he himself to come down and have the guts to do it in a public meeting. If not, to shut his big mouth.
Showdown at City Hall, Commissioner versus Police Chief.
What I am seeing and hearing from this police chief is scary.
Political theater and possible consequences.
What I want is a full investigation.
The details behind the drama.
He's a bold guy, just like all of you.
You see the skeleton. We're closing them.
A terrifying journey.
All we pretty much care about is to get out.
A new start in South Florida with an uncertain ending.
We're going to get this done.
Big battles in Washington. A Miami congressman weighs in.
It's all live this week in South Florida.
Good morning. Welcome. Glad you could join us. I'm Michael Putney.
I'm Glenna Milburn. The Miami drama. The future of Haitian migrants in South Florida. A lot packed into this hour for you, but we begin with the battle over the bill.
The monumental battle underway in Washington between factions of the Democratic Party over a $1 trillion infrastructure bill held up and used as leverage for an even bigger bill to address so-called human infrastructure, expanded Medicare, help for struggling families, and climate protection initiatives. Republicans are watching the disarray among Democrats with pleasure, but they are also not in the clear. They are, in fact, in the hot seat because those big bills will be coming up soon for a vote. The infrastructure bill passed the Senate with strong bipartisan support. The House deadline to vote on it is the end of the month. So what should we expect when a South Florida's veteran members of Congress, Mario Diaz-Balart, a Republican from Miami-Dade, is joining us now to weigh in. Congressman, good morning. Great to see you.
Good morning, Congressman.
Well, I cannot hear the Congressman. I hope that he hears us. Congressman, are we good?
Yes.
We are. Great. You know, first of all, I should say that the infrastructure package is really in your wheelhouse since you are the ranking Republican on the House subcommittee on transportation, roads, highways, and you've brought millions of dollars to South Florida for those kinds of projects. So that bill did pass the Senate in August with strong bipartisan support. When it comes to the House vote, will you vote for it?
Michael, what you said is accurate. It passed the Senate in August. It's been sitting in the House. The only reason that the Speaker, Nancy Pelosi, has not brought it forward, it's because it's linked to the much bigger bill, which would entirely change the economy of the United States from a free market economy to a government-controlled, more socialist economy, and they are linked.
Excuse me, how in the world can one bill, even one as big as $1.2 trillion, how can that change the entire economy?
Again, it's linked to the bigger one, and when I say it's linked, I say it, but more importantly, Speaker Pelosi says it's linked. The President of the United States says it's linked. Senator Bernie Sanders, whose bill it is, says it's linked. And it's been, part of it has been sitting in August, since August in the House. The reason they haven't brought it forward is because it's linked to the bigger one. And the bigger one, which entails, by the way, don't take my word for it, it has most of the Green New Deal, which the one who created that, AOC Chief Staff, said, not an environmental bill, it's to change the economy. It's put together by the self-described socialist in the Senate, Senator Bernie Sanders, who has said that he wants to change from a market-driven economy to a socialist economy. So again, there's no secret here. Nobody's hiding it. It may not be getting all the coverage, but it is absolutely linked, and it would have the effect of changing the economy, as those members who are part of it have said themselves, from a free market system to a socialist market, a socialist control system. That's why, by the way, the Democrats, even among themselves, are having such a difficult time, you know, getting this done, because I think a lot of them understand that this is more than just a bill. This is transforming the country in a way that, frankly, I don't think the American people want.
All right. So, wow, let's unpack that a little bit. And I think you and I are both having a couple of mic problems today. So I think we've got that all ironed out. So, hi, Congressman. Let's undo a little of that. So The two bills absolutely are trying to be linked by some in the Democratic Party. That's why there hasn't been a vote yet, to your point. So this, you know, this bill, the human infrastructure bill that is so controversial at the moment is what they call it, because it's, you know, you could look at it as a big spending for a lot of things that's not hard infrastructure. The people who are such proponents of it are looking at it as an investment in people, which is a human infrastructure as well. So my question to you is, the number's really big, and, you know, we've been hearing once you get past like a trillion, I think people just, their minds don't wrap around that. But what minds do wrap around is programs and all of those things I'm sure everyone is for, but for what they cost. So give us a sense of what it takes. Well, what would you take out and what would you keep in to get to a number that you might consider?
Yeah, Glenn, and it's more than just a number. It's the policies behind that. Because let's be very clear, you can tweak it to score, what we call score, whatever number you want, by postponing the implementation of certain parts, delaying them, sunsetting them, even though you know that, frankly, it's going to be impossible to not continue them. So you can tweak the number from, you know, multi-trillion to a trillion or less. It's the policy. So when you have policies, for example, for disincentivizing work, when you have policy to you know, pay people to stay at home, when you have, again, big parts of the Green New Deal, and I know that it may sound a little bit you know, overstated, but let's be clear. The Green New Deal, the person who drafted it, the chief of staff of Congresswoman Cortez, stated in plain English that this was not an economic changing model. That's what he tried to do.
Congressman, I'm sorry. You know, these bills have lots of fingerprints on them. I'm sure AOC staff does. But 435 members of the House where you sit, 100 senators, everybody is weighing in. Let me just point out that the bill you're talking about, the so-called soft infrastructure bill, is not for just needless thing. It's universal pre-K, free community college for 2 years, paid family leave, expanding Medicare, elder care, and then climate change. Now, whether you think it's the Green New Deal or not, there's a lot of money in there that is needed for resilience for climate change. Would you disagree with that?
Michael, you know that I put $12 billion in the bill, the last, after the, some of the larger storms, for resiliency. You can do that, as I did, without destroying the free market system. And so, you know, you mentioned some of the things that are in there. Everything is in that bill, but here's the bottom line. It will not only, again, indebt this country to a point of tying our hands in the future, by the way, but it will also, again, disincentivize work. And it is the beginning of the Venezuelization of our economy. But again, it's
can
not-
you, Can you just explain what you mean by that? Because, I mean, things like money for childcare actually incentivizes work for women. That just is an example. But what do you mean, Congressman, when you say the socialization or the Venezuelization or whatever word you just used? What does that mean, practically speaking?
Not an easy word to say, by the way, I admit. Look, what it is, again, is changing the free market system to something that we would not recognize.
And like, so, what, how does it change? Honestly, this is a sincere question. How does that change the free market system? How does that change it?
The Green New Deal, which a big part of it is incorporated in this legislation. You know, you mentioned some parts. And by the way, it's really funny. You're accurate when you say free college for 2 years. So after that, what happens? Well, what they're counting on is that these programs will stay there forever, but then the price tag goes from $3.5 trillion to what? $10 trillion, $12 trillion, $50 trillion? It's unlimited. They have everything that you can think of, that the more radical elements, this is not an issue of Republicans or Democrats, all right? This is the more radical left-wing elements, the things that they have never been able to do pass on their own, they have put in this bill, including most, you know, most of the most damaging elements of the Green New Deal. By the way, one of the reasons that Senator Manchin, who represents West Virginia, is having a such difficulty supporting this is precisely because he understands that it destroys the production of domestic energy. It incentivizes people to stay home, pays them to stay home.
Yeah, let me, I'm sorry, jump in here. He did say the other day that he didn't want to create a entitlement society. That seems to be his main objection to this American Jobs Bill, I think as it's called.
Correct. And I think that's exactly right. In other words, it is the largest expansion of entitlements, since the New Deal, potentially even larger than the New Deal, at a time when we are seeing that when you pay people to not work, it's not that they're evil, they won't work. And so it is, again, the largest expansion of entitlements. By the way, also the largest tax increase in the history of the United States. The biggest increase of spending in the history of the United States. It will force massive tax increases on everybody. The president said during the campaign that he would not agree to anything that would raise taxes on people making less than $400,000. All sorts of independent groups have stated that this is a huge tax increase on the middle class, on everyone. It's a job killer. Who would benefit, by the way, is China. Ironically, the biggest beneficiary, if this bill were to become law, would be Communist Chinese Party, because it would open the door for massive exportation of American jobs, mostly to China. Again, it's not that only the Republicans don't like it. That's why the Democrats are having a hard time supporting this legislation.
Congressman, real quick, and before we hit break, and we'll come back afterwards because we have a lot to talk about, but can you just explain that? What do you mean exporting jobs to China? That is a difficult thing to wrap our head around in this bill.
Yeah, but I'll put it in the most simple way. The taxes for American businesses would be higher here than they would be in China. And so here's the question. Remember, jobs had left to China, manufacturing jobs. They started coming back in droves, if you have reported in the past. When the taxes were reduced to the American people and to the job creators. And again, this would mean that they're going to pay a lot more to do business here than in China. It's not rocket science. I mean, you know, we've seen this movie before. And so it's hard to believe that despite the facts, they would move forward on something so dramatic. But again, as you all mentioned at the beginning of the show, the debate is between Democrats. And Michael, when you talked about, you know, I've been Mr. Infrastructure for a long, long time, and yeah, my record speaks for itself. They're not talking to any of the Republicans. They're not asking for.
Well, they'll at some point they will ask
changes, improvements.
They will
not
ask
from
for
anybody.
Vote.
They're trying to stuff it through as is. They're trying to stuff it through as is.
Yeah. Congressman Mario Díaz-Balart, hold tight. We have more questions for you. We'll be back with more questions for him in just a minute. On this Sunday, we are having a lively discussion with Congressman Mario Díaz-Balart of Miami. Congressman, let me ask you a little bit more about money. During the Trump years, the national deficit increased by $8 trillion, and frankly, there was nary a peep from Republicans in Congress. Now the Democrats are going to raise it even more, and Republicans like you are just, you know, going crazy. So was it okay not to object during the Trump era, but it's fine now?
No, I would argue that I think that we've been spending too much money for quite a long time now. But let's just put it in perspective. What we're dealing with now, if they succeed, it would be more spending than all of the years where the Republicans controlled the House combined, Michael. So if, and I would argue that we did, we spent too much money in the past, this is by far the largest tax increase, spending increase. And there's a reason, by the way, why there's a new word in our vocabulary that the three of us have not used in decades, and that's inflation. People are getting hit really hard with inflation precisely because of the government policies of just excessive spending at a rate which, by the way, we have never, ever seen in the history of our country.
So you and you voted yes for this temporary raise in the limit, and so did the other Miami-Dade GOP congressmen and women, man and woman. So that has a shelf life. What happens next? Is this kicking the can down the road? What happens next? On December 3rd.
Correct, Glenna. The appropriation bills are some of the things that have to get done. There was an extension of the current law, in essence, just for a little while to allow us to get that done. But right now, the majority, House, Senate, and the White House, is not focused on the things that have to get done. They're focused on the things that they want to get done, including the Bernie Sanders proposed budget. And so I'm hoping that we will get the necessary things done and that we will stop trying to impose on the American people something that they don't want, that they ever asked for. Look, this president ran as a moderate. And right now, by the way, these proposals have been put together by Senator Bernie Sanders. And so it looks like Biden got elected, but Bernie Sanders' ideas and proposals are the ones that he's pushing. It's time to get back to the people's business, the things that have to get done. You mentioned one of those that really needs to get done.
Yeah, Congressman, let me ask you to expand a little bit on the subject of inflation, which means things cost more and our dollar doesn't go quite as far. In the last period, the something called the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, which is used by the Fed, went up by 4.3%. I mean, that's just a huge amount. And I think one way the Fed would say to bring it down is to raise interest rates. Do you think the Fed, in fact, should go ahead and raise interest rates, make money more expensive?
No, frankly, what I think we need to do, where I think the emphasis needs to be, is on not continue to add fuel to the fire. And so among the biggest increases, obviously, in prices and inflation is energy. One of the first things that this president did the first day was to basically declare war on all of domestic energy in the United States, while, by the way, getting rid of sanctions that sanctioned oil and coal in places like Russia and China. Hard to believe. So again, it's these policies that are creating the problem. Like it's this president that created the crisis in the southern border. It's this president that created the catastrophe in Afghanistan. This is very simple. These are government-created crises that don't need to be there. So it's time for this administration to take a deep breath, slow down, start working for the things that the American people need, not to appease Bernie Sanders and AOC, the most radical folks in the country.
So you saw the president on Capitol Hill. And your word is appease. I think other people on the other side would use negotiate. I mean, it's clear that the sausage is being made. That kind of makes people's eyes glaze over who maybe aren't watching this program and aren't in the weeds with that. But isn't there a sense that you have that this president is negotiating with members of his own party that did not get elected president in order to come to some sort of compromise, which you are very involved in?
Oh no, as you all know, I'm pretty good at negotiations, right? Of getting things done. Yeah, there's no doubt that they're trying to get the Democrats to do this. Now, here's the sad part. If they actually took a step back and started working in a bipartisan or nonpartisan basis, I think the country would be better off for it. But that's not what they're doing, despite the fact that the president ran saying that he would do that. So you're absolutely right that what they're trying to do is negotiate, break arms, whatever they're trying to do to get the Democrats to vote for it. And the fact that the Democrats so far are reluctant tells you just how extreme this legislation really is.
Yeah. Congressman, before we run out of time, one Florida-centric question I need to ask you. You are astute politically, and you've been in the legislature, now you're in Congress. The approval ratings for Governor Ron DeSantis took kind of a sharp dip here in recent days. He was in the mid to lower 50s. Now he's in the mid 40s. Is his reelection at all in question?
I don't think so at all, Michael, because his numbers dipped when the numbers of COVID spiked, as everybody knew was going to happen here. Now they're going down dramatically. There's not as much coverage, obviously, when the numbers go down as when they're going up. I think he's done an amazing job as governor. He's a heck of a leader. I would put my money on him getting reelected.
Prognostication from Congressman Mario Diaz-Balart. Always love having you on the program. Great to see you, and thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Congressman. Great to have you.
Thank you both. Hopefully we can do it in person soon.
I hope so. All right, next, the eruption this week at Miami City Hall.
We have an insider's look at what's happening there. Former Miami Police Chief George Colina is with us live next. The drama, the political theater this week at the Miami Commission had fingers pointing in lots of directions.
Did they ever? Commissioner Joe Carrillo led the Inquisition-like meetings, building a case against the new police chief, but the chief struck back. He struck first with a memo alleging corruption among Carrillo and the other commissioners.
In this real-life telenovela, there are subplots, there is context, and one person who might shed some authentic light on all of it is Miami's recently retired police chief, George Colina, with us right there live. So great to have you. Can we just call you George now?
Yes, you can, and it's nice to be on. Thank you.
George, so, it's great to see you. Thank
you. I just
want
to say, we are not making light of anything. This is a very serious situation. But for Miami watchers, there were a lot of eyes rolling. There were a lot of sighs. There were a lot of eyebrows raising. Kind of put this into context for us, what we've seen, which was an inquisition-like couple of meetings this week with one commissioner in particular, sort of laying out a case against the police chief with no response.
Right, and I think, you know, it's a sad commentary that we've kind of seen this in the past, right? This level of discord. You never want to see this at the highest levels of any government leadership, but when it's your home, certainly more so. And it does leave people quite uneasy because honestly, you want everybody to focus on their jobs and doing the best they can for the community that they serve, not spending time preparing on how you're going to fight each other.
George, it was only at the end of January that you retired after 3 years as chief, 30 years with the department. So you know this department inside and out, and you have watched Chief Acevedo in the 6 months he's been on the job. He's made some mistakes, some gaffes, but has he done anything, in your opinion, that would warrant having him fired?
You know, I don't know is the truth. From the outside, it doesn't appear like it. But we don't know what the truth is, right? I'm not in the department anymore. I don't live in the city of Miami anymore. And so certainly there have been some mistakes in terms of how you would communicate, especially strategically. It's one of the disadvantages, Michael, when you bring someone from the outside, and I'm not questioning the decision, but those are some of the things that sometimes lead to problems, not understanding a community, not understanding the politics, how to maneuver around some of these landmines that we know exist here in South Florida. I can't speak to other cities. I don't know how it was for him in Houston. But these are some of the things that happened. There was a process that was put in place that wasn't followed. So there's tinder, you know, how much is reality and how much is, you know, perhaps an exaggeration of what it is or being a bit hyperbolic. That's the part that really everyone is trying to figure out.
So we're talking about Miami, but there are cities all over South Florida who make hiring and firing decisions. In Miami, it's the city manager. The city manager and the mayor sort of went to Houston, plucked him, called him the Michael Jordan of police chiefs. The commission had not only no part in the hiring, but were very surprised, even though there was this internal process going on where local inter-department people were candidates for this job. And you get the sense listening to the meeting that this was kind of, this was poking the bear, no doubt. But the memo that the chief launched in a preemptive strike really makes some allegations against the commissioners that they interfered with investigations in the department, that they were meddling in his decisions to hire and fire. Did you, when you were police chief, have that experience with the commissioners? And several commissioners, I might say, were different then, but did you ever experience
sure.
that?
Not really. I'll put it this way. It was important to me from the very beginning. Anytime I had any conversation with any of the commissioners, and by the way, to include the mayor and the manager, it was really important to me to make sure they understood what was acceptable to me and what wasn't. It was important for me that they understood that I'm the chief of police. I'm going to make the decisions. We can speak. you know, off camera, if you will, about it, certainly not at commission. I was never comfortable with that. And have a discussion if someone's uncomfortable with the decision I was making. But I certainly wanted them to know I'm making the decisions here. And if I even got the idea that someone was suggesting something that made me uncomfortable, I would let them know about it. I would let them know.
Can I just follow up with that? Because we have evidence that you did exactly that. There is one of the allegations against commissioners were that they were asking the police chief to do selective enforcement mm-hmm. against a code violation, send in the city departments to bust political enemies. There is an entity on Cayocho, Ball and Chain, and the owners of that establishment and others filed suit this week, a federal lawsuit. And in that lawsuit is your memo from 2 years ago when you were police chief. It seems to be answering to the mayor and manager that you had been asked to do selective enforcement, and you were asking them to sort of gut check and have that and intervene so it didn't happen. Talk about that a little bit, that experience.
So this was a commission meeting where, if I recall, they had essentially through resolution directed the city attorney to essentially be the point person in these business checks, which, you know, I'm sure they felt like it was their right as legislators to put forth such a resolution. The city attorney followed those directions and forwarded locations for us to check as a task force. That already for me was uncomfortable. And again, I'm sure they felt like they were within their right. But in my opinion, that's not how the charter reads. My boss is the city manager. And that's the person who can direct me on what my duties are. But quite frankly, even the city manager, you know, I'm the law enforcement professional, right? I'm the one that's got to be able to say that is not acceptable or I'm not going to participate, because perception is what it's all about. I don't want anyone to think that anyone can use the police department, the mayor, the manager, any of the commissioners to think that we can go out and do their bidding. I don't want anyone to think that. And so it's important to make these statements, to be really blunt about them, to be honest, so everyone understands, because I really believe that a lot of times they don't realize what they may be asking, and it's incumbent upon the leadership, whether it's the chief or the manager or whoever, to say, hold on, let's make sure that everyone stays in their lane. Let's make sure everyone understands the separation of powers, because when they're commingled, it becomes uncomfortable, and what the public thinks really matters.
Yeah.
And so I have no problem with a commissioner saying, I've gotten tips that this business is functioning illegally. That's okay, but I'm not gonna go check that one business. I'm gonna check the one next door, the one across the street, and the one down the block. Because again, I don't want anyone to feel that we're being used or manipulated in any kind of way.
Right, well, just to underscore your point, the Miami City Charter says that you report to the city manager, and the commissioners can express opinions, but they cannot give you or police officers a direct order. That just violates the charter. That's what you're saying.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. And listen, using common sense, right? I'm completely okay with a commissioner calling and saying, I just got a tip from a constituent that they're selling drugs out of this home or there's this yeah. business. That for me is like any citizen reaching out, that's okay. It's when you get the idea that they're trying to direct you on how to do your job or essentially giving you instructions or orders that can become uncomfortable.
Yeah, that's not kosher. Okay, George Kalina, we have more questions for you, so please stay right where you are, and we'll be back with more questions for the former police chief in a minute.
We are back with former Miami Police Chief, retired Miami Police Chief George Kalina, trying to put some context into what we saw at the city this week in the City Commission. George, you know, not very recently, but when Chief Acevedo first started about a month into his tenure, we were having a conversation and I just said, hey, how's it going? You know, how do you like being the chief in Miami? And he said, you know, it's like being in the Game of Thrones. And I think at that point, he didn't really quite get how much he would think that in months to come. But why isn't he answering now with such a public thrashing? Why stay upstairs at the commission? Why not come down and answer to them?
I think it's a great question. I really do. And I don't know why. It would be difficult for me to not respond, right? And to be fair to the commissioners, right? I mean, that's their forum and they get to ask whatever questions they want to ask. And I think Commissioner Carollo basically explained it. Hey, this is my opportunity to address some of these allegations made against me. And so he used his platform, quite frankly, to be able to do that and address some of the allegations made against him. I feel that it should be both ways, right? I feel like certainly the chief should come down. Perhaps he was told, I don't want to add fuel to this fire. It's not going to help. But I think it would have been important to hear from the chief to address some of the concerns and the allegations that were lodged against him that were also very serious. I would have liked to have heard from him as well. And I think that you can find a certain amount of civility to discuss it in a civil way, even if there's disagreement. But I think it's important for the public to hear every side of these arguments.
Yeah, we should point out for the record that we invited Chief Acevedo to be on the show today. And the answer we got late in the week to our executive producer, Tommy Fletcher, was, I am prohibited from appearing, making any appearances. So we just want to get that on the record. George, on Friday, the commission passed the strangest resolution I can think of. They're going to hire maybe a former FBI man or other detectives to come in and do an investigation, not just of Chief Acevedo, but of themselves. And then this investigator or investigators would report to them. I mean, how in the world can that happen?
Well, I understand the thought, right, that so much is being put out in the public and it's going to raise a concern. And so you want transparency and you want the truth to come out. I certainly understand that. But to your point, ultimately, I think the best way to go is to have a legitimate third party, be it the FBI or FDLE or whoever it is, to come out and conduct their own investigation where they're not reporting back to the city anything other than their findings. I think that would have been ideal. Perhaps that might still happen. You know, as you know, that the city has also an auditor general. And some of these things that are perhaps figures or facts or dates that are in question, perhaps this person can help. It's their job to try to do that independently. That's a possibility as well.
George Kalina, retired Miami chief, we value your time, and I guess we'll all be watching this together. So come back soon.
Thank you very much, George. Appreciate it.
Have a great Sunday.
You too.
All right, next, of the thousands of Haitian immigrants taken from that squalid encampment at the southern border, many are here with relatives and sponsors in South Florida.
What's next for them? We separate the fiction from the facts with those on the front lines. That's next.
Despite the focus on the mass expulsion of Haitians from that now empty border camp in Del Rio, Texas, the majority of the people who were there are now in the U.S. and beginning the asylum claims process.
And countless will be doing that while living with relatives or sponsors right here in South Florida. We met some of those families here this week whose experiences shed some light on questions and confusion in the process. First, though, their firsthand accounts of what they chose to endure. They arrived strangers in South Florida. Stephanie and her 4-year-old, Yvonne, Jimmy and his young family, all describing a similar terrifying journey to the border.
You see the skeleton with clothes on them, with dead bodies, you smell it. You have people as you walking up the mountain that they just give up. At the moment we were under the bridge, all we pretty much care about is to get out, to make it.
All had been there under the bridge in Del Rio, the human crisis riveting a nation. Haitians, some for years in Brazil and Chile, trying to sustain their families there, hearing word of mouth last spring, the U.S. was ready to take them in.
There he said, I made a cousin. I'm in Texas.
And he sent you a map before
he left. Yeah, and he sent me the address to where he was at.
They are among the families granted the prize chance at the asylum process. Their rescues and resources now depend on relatives or nonprofits like Giving Hearts with Love Foundation. So much of the money they had to spend along the way was to the smugglers, so-called guides along the routes.
Sometimes they actually pay $5 or $2. The same people that guiding you, they're the same people that's robbing, raping.
Relatives were raped. Jimmy was injured, implored to keep going for his family. While we were there, Jimmy had to check in electronically with immigration. Stephanie was fitted for GPS tracking as her asylum case progresses. All tell us faith brought them here. Hope keeps them going.
My God was with me. I wasn't by myself.
So by all accounts, they've been having similar accounts, but different experiences as they begin this asylum process, which is a process, as you know, tangled in political finger-pointing and bureaucratic delays and some legitimate questions.
Well, to answer some of those questions, we've invited Cassandra Supren. She is with us, an attorney for Americans for Immigrant Justice, AIJ, well-respected organization. Ms. Supren, good morning or good afternoon by this point. We're glad you could join us.
Thank you for having me.
Could you tell us what generally are the chances that these Haitians who arrived will have an asylum claim granted to them? What are their chances?
Well, the chances are very slim because the Miami Immigration Court, for instance, has a high denial rate. In addition to that, they are not afforded public defenders. They're not appointing counsel. They need to hire their own attorney, which if they're lucky, they could have services from us, which is a nonprofit organization, but we have extremely limited resources. So they would have to appoint an attorney, get the testimony, get the documents, have a, plus they're being cross-examined by DHS and also the judge, given the low successful rate of and the high denial grants and of asylum, it's very hard for them to get asylum.
Cassandra, since we covered the initial this crisis at the border, and it was a humanitarian crisis by all accounts, no doubt, and the message from the administration was, don't come because you will be expelled. And we watched those flights take off for Port-au-Prince, summarily expelling and deporting some of the people who were under the camp. But the vast majority were not deported. And it raises a lot of questions like why? And we're looking at some of that video now, why were these people in particular expelled under a health policy, Title 42, because of the COVID pandemic, and yet three quarters of the people who were there were not expelled, and some were vaccinated, some were tested, some were not vaccinated, some were not tested. Why is there such a discrepancy in who gets to do what?
Before I answer that question, I want to dispel this myth. Please note that there are a lot of Haitians that have been removed. Over 6,000 have been expelled to Haiti, not counting Guatemala, Mexico. So the majority of being allowed here is not necessarily true given the numbers we're getting.
Let me just clarify that I'm talking about the numbers from that encampment, and those are the numbers that the Department of Homeland Security has publicly put out from that one instance at the border camp.
Okay, but we have documentation that there's more, there have been over 6,000 Haitians have been expelled. However, to answer that question, we don't know exactly the criteria that the government is using to use Title 42 or Title 8, because we have seen people who have been expelled back to Haiti or families with young children, and we have seen ones who have been processed here with family and children. So we really don't know what criteria they're using to make such decision.
Yeah. Cassandra, both Glenna and I are very well acquainted with AIJ, Americans for Immigrant Justice. Your founder and executive director, Cheryl Little, is a friend. We have immense respect for her and the work that AIJ does. But if you do have limited resources, so where are these all these Haitians who are here now? They are going to need legal representation. Where will they get it?
They may get it through our organization. We have another sister organization called Catholic Legal Services as well. But you have to be very mindful that we have very extremely limited resources. And also, unfortunately, they would have to pay for their attorney because the public defender system does not exist in immigration court.
You know, I want to pose to you a question that I've been hearing a lot over the past couple of weeks with people who are not familiar with this process, who are watching the news and seeing what's happening. And it comes from, and we all understand that the whole immigration issue is so mired in politics. Weeding through that, there are people who feel like they see all of these people at the border, they see all of these people come in, they're quite sure that people will just disappear into the ether and live illegally and not go through the process. And yet, in just the very example we showed today, Stephanie had a GPS monitor on her ankle, and Jimmy was checking in on his own with his immigration agent. And I'd like to hear from you, and our viewers would like to hear from you, that how do these people go through the process for a couple of years legally and rightfully on their own accord? And it is the honesty system, is it not?
I'm sorry, could you rephrase the question? I'm not really understanding.
People are who have now been granted the asylum process are here doing that. And there is a process that they are trusted to follow. And I'd like to hear your experiences with those who do or maybe do not.
Well, those who do not follow, basically the video that you have shown in terms of Stephanie having an ankle monitor and Jimmy being having to report to ICE remotely, just so you know, before they are released, there are conditions they have to meet. They can't be menace to society. And also they need to follow certain criteria upon being released. If they follow through the system, they will go to court, file their asylum claim, and hopefully if it gets granted, they get granted. If they don't follow the process upon being released, once they get apprehended, they'll go back to the detention facilities.
Yeah, Cassandra, we understand that the immigration courts, not just in South Florida, but across the country, are just jammed. They are way behind on, you know, hearing the cases. How long might it be for the Haitians who arrived in the last week, the ones whom Glenna spoke to, before they actually get a hearing before an immigration judge?
It depends. The Biden administration has instituted a dedicated docket that is devoted to Haitian to asylum seekers. I'm sorry, asylum seekers with families. And if you're under that docket, please note that not all families are under that docket. If you're under that docket, the projected goal is to have your final hearing within a year. If you're in the non-dedicated docket, it could take years.
And what is your experience, practically speaking, time-wise?
In terms for asylum?
Yes, or the process.
Well, unfortunately, given COVID, the court systems have not been as, they're not hearing cases as often. So now we're seeing hearings scheduled for 2023, 2024, unfortunately.
Well, Cassandra Suprin from Americans for Immigrant Justice, AIJ, we appreciate your time and we wish you well with your representation of Haitian migrants. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Cassandra.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back.
We thank you so much for being here with us. We are grateful you spent this hour with us. And remember, we are always online 24/7 at local10.com.
And also remember, as always, stay informed, get involved. Hope you have a great Sunday.